All right, welcome back, everyone. I'm very pleased to introduce the next speaker. Thomas Bonnard is the head of the Department of Cognitive Biology at the University of Vienna. He's a pioneer of social cognition in corvids, where he has investigated social learning, deception, perspective taking, and theory of mind. His research has explored the convergent evolution of complex cognitive traits in corvids, such as ravens, and primates, showing that these evolutionarily distant lineages have each evolved flexible strategies for dealing with the complex politics of group living. Please welcome Thomas, whose talk is titled Raven Politics, Understanding and Use of Third-Party Relations.
Yeah, so thanks for the introduction and thanks for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be here. The more general title of my project of the last couple of years has been Raven Politics, and I guess you can get an idea of where this title actually comes from. So it has been quite a popular book, quite an important one in the early 80s by Franz de Waal called Chimpanzee Politics. And when I was starting working on ravens, I saw a couple of things and told these kind of anecdotes to my colleagues. And
Thomas, I think they want you louder.
And yeah, so it's... So I told it to my colleagues, and eventually, at several occasions, it then popped up that, oh, hey, but you are talking about chimpanzee politics, so they are doing things like chimpanzee politics. So at some point I said, no, now it's enough, now we call it raven politics, and we have a look at how they understand and use the social knowledge, and that's what I'd like to talk about today. We already got an introduction about social intelligence hypothesis, originally phrased by Alison Jolly and Nick Humphrey in the 60s and 70s, and the basic idea is that dealing with others poses problems because individuals as intentional beings act autonomously, which makes their behavior difficult to predict, and even worse, individuals also respond to being acted upon, which makes them difficult to manipulate in comparison to inanimate objects. And the basic idea is now that the more complex social life becomes, the better individuals need to becoming coping with these kind of problems, and this should then have an effect of their processing capacities and of course also some areas of their brain. And even though the whole idea is very intuitive, I think we have still quite a problem in understanding what constitutes complexity in social life and also what kind of processing capacities are selected for. And this is exactly what I'm interested in. So now in respect to convergence. The idea of social intelligence has been coined on primates, or developed on primates, and then, as we already heard, it has been also applied to other mammalian species, such as social carnivores, the hyenas, or dolphins, recently also on elephants. And a couple of years ago, people have also started applying this idea on birds, in particular members of the groups of parrots and corvids. And the interesting thing here is that the last common ancestor between a mammal and a bird has lived not about 90 million years ago, but about 300 million years ago. So, of course, there is some kind of heritage coming, but my argument is that if we find certain skills in some mammal species and in some bird species, it's very unlikely that it goes back to a common ancestor, in particular not when we are talking about higher cognitive skills. But it's much more likely that it's the result of what we call convergent evolution, meaning that certain selection pressures have favored particular social skills, cognitive skills, sorry. And for me, the interesting thing now working on birds is that this allows us to test a hypothesis that has been developed on primates independently of phylogeny, or almost independently of phylogeny. So. And the last couple of years, I have been working intensively on this species. It's the common raven, and it's a member of the corvid family, so this means that it has a relatively large brain. So I would like to leave it with this. Anybody who is interested in brains, ask me later. Another issue on ravens is that they are highly ecologically flexible. You can find them world round in the northern hemisphere, basically in every habitat. But what I specifically like on them very much is that their social behavior is quite elaborate. And when I started, we already knew a little bit about the social foraging. And when we had a closer look at this, it turned out that they can really be characterized as Machiavellian players, if you want to. I personally was working then on the competition about hidden food, and here they really also show what's called a Machiavellian mind. They are very good in deceiving others in the sense of withholding information, potentially even providing false information. An example of withholding is here. So a raven is about to catch food, sees another raven nearby that doesn't have any food. So what it does is usually stops caching. And if there is an obstacle nearby, it might go behind the obstacle and hides itself for caching and resumes caching there. We also have quite good evidence that they are kind of capable of taking others' perspective, potentially also attribute knowledge. This is the first study we did in this respect. So we had three, if you have three ravens, two of which can observe a human making a food cache in a big room, and later you allow one raven to go back into this room either together with another raven that has also seen this cache being made, or a raven that has not seen this cache being made, because we blocked his view at that time. He instantly discriminates between those individuals and goes very quickly with a former observer and delays with a former non-observer. So he waits until this one is far, far, far away from the actual cache, and then he goes there and takes it, suggesting that they basically can understand who is knowledgeable and who is ignorant about the food caches because they have or haven't seen it being made before. The interesting thing about the whole all these kind of capacities or abilities is that they do, ravens are not born with them like this, but they do develop, and they only emerge at a certain age or developmental step. And to put it in a nutshell, what the ravens are doing in this particular context is kind of comparable with what human children are doing between 1 and 2 years old. I mean, they're 2 years old. And I also have to say that ravens are not the only species who can do these kind of things, but we also have evidence from other corvids, in particular the scrub jays. So what you might then say is that the abilities of corvids in competing with others for hidden food is kind of a special adaptation to this very particular context. The alternative is that this is only a small piece of the bigger picture, and the bigger picture is actually that they live in that they have a rather complex social life, which is composed of competitive and cooperative interactions in particular, where individuals have to deal with social networks based on different types of social relationships. So here we are back on the convergent idea of social complexity now. And so this is exactly what I got interested in now. And the problem here is that the problem that what we faced so far was that hardly anything is known about the social life of ravens. So all what we knew so far is that they tend to aggregate at food sources. But you know, aggregating at food sources, and that their groups are very fluid, so the individuals come and go. So this is not exactly the scenario which we need to come up with these kind of predictions. So in the recent project we had, tried to take an integrative approach and ask three main questions. And the first one was basically, how complex is raven social life in terms of social structure and relationships? What do they actually know about these relationships, and how do they use them then in daily life? And I would like to go through all three questions now very quickly. But before I do, I also explain you how we work. So I try to combine field and lab studies. And in the lab, we have new aviaries, rather big aviary complex, actually, where we have a colony of about 30 ravens that are, most of them are hand-raised, so they work quite nicely in different types of experiments. And on the other side, we have a field site in the Northern Alps, where we catch an individual mark raven so that we can distinguish them with colored wing tags and rings. And we do observe them usually when they make use out of anthropogenic food resources like garbage dumps. In our case, a local zoo, where when the zoo animals like wolves or wild boars are fed, the ravens come and participate. And the first thing, this is our study site. This is the valley of the River Alm. And I'm referring now to some data collected by a PhD student, Anna Braun. We had a look at the grouping behavior of the ravens there. And so this is the area of the wild park, and we had a look on the composition and the size of the groups, and it turns out that there are really very strong dynamics over the day. Ravens come in the morning for foraging, they form bigger groups, and then during the day they disperse and hang out in small groups. But interestingly, they stay in this area. And the reason for this is most likely, so this is just to symbolize the strong dynamics of going together with others and then leaving others again, so fission fusion. And the reason why they stay in this area is mostly because the other parts of the valley are occupied by territorial breeders, so they're not allowed to go there. So, but this is only one level of dynamics they show. You have also a second level, namely the birds can decide whether or not to stay in the valley or go somewhere else. And most of the birds do so, so they spend some time here and then go somewhere else. But it turned also that about one-third of the birds hardly do so. They prefer to stay here for over a long-term period, so several months or up to several seasons and years. And so they do form local subgroups, which regularly meet on a daily basis. And Matthias Loretto then, is a new PhD candidate, he had a look on what ravens are doing when they're leaving the valley. And this is what you can see here. So this is our study site, and where the ravens are meeting each other at these kind of small areas. And when you go outside somewhere else in the Austrian Alps, you see the same kind of patterns in other places. So basically, the two individuals that meet here may also meet at other places repeatedly. And I think this is now gives us a very nice background so that we can show, yes, it does pay off to the for ravens to remember with whom they're interacting, because it's quite a likelihood to actually meet them again. So when they interact with others, they may form social relationships. And there is in particular one type of social relationship that is very interesting for us, namely social bonds or affiliate social relations. So the positive, the nice ones, and which are basically expressed via grooming or even analog on preening by different types of mutual contact, and which are very often playful. And these kind of behaviors, and you see when animals pair up and form a long-term pair bond, so we call them mates, and they are usually also reproductively active. But you can also find this among siblings in the first years and among other individuals that are non-relatives, and they are also non-reproductively active, so we call them friends. And so for the purpose of this talk, I lump these two categories and just call them social bonds. Importantly, so this is a colleague of mine, Ola Fraser. She had a look at the observational protocols of our she had a look at the observations of our captive birds and analyzed these kind of social bonds and compared them with those of primates, in particular chimpanzees, and it turned out that the components of social relationship quality were exactly the same, suggesting that we can really talk about very similar things here. Interestingly, though, the number of bonding partners the ravens have per time is much smaller, as we find in the primates. It's usually only a few of them, very often one, maybe two, three, up to five. And most bonds are between male-females already, but importantly, they are independent of age classes. It's not only that the older birds do this, it's also that young birds already start doing these kind of things. And what I forgot to list here is that bonding helps a lot. So if you have a bonding partner, you raise in rank, because bonding partners tend to support each other in fights. So we have all this kind of third-party interventions business there as well. Coming back to this in a second. So given that bonds seem to play a role in raven social life, so the next question was, and how much do they actually understand about them? And so first we did a couple of playback studies, testing for their knowledge about their own social relation. This was Georgina Zipper and Markus Berkner, two PhD candidates as well. And they could show that they can very nicely discriminate between the sounds of form of unfamiliar ravens and familiar ravens. And within the second category, the familiar one, they can also discriminate from animals they like, so their friends, and those that they don't like. And they can do this even when they have heard the others 3 years ago, or when they have seen the others last time 3 years ago. So this is kind of a robust finding. But of course, and the most important thing for me was, what's about understanding the relationship between other individuals from a third-party perspective. So So basically that if this individual here knows that these two are friends because they are playing. And from our observations in the field, it was quite evident that there are a lot of situations where this kind of knowledge or this kind of knowledge would be quite important. So, for instance, this individual here, unfortunately, is not really good. So it might be quite good for this one to understand who is affiliated with whom, so who are the bonding partners here in order to do the right decision and in with whom to interact in what way. So to actually check for the possibility that they do understand third-party relations, we went back in the Avery and did an experiment. In this case, I did this together with a postdoc, Jörg Massner, and a PhD student, Andreas Pascuconis, who was helping us here with the playback stuff. And we used the fact that we just got our new Averys, and we had at that time two groups of ravens for housed next to each other, let's say the yellow and the blue group, next to each other for about a year or so. And those Averys, they were in, so the groups were in visual distance and acoustical as well, so they could see and hear each other, but they could not interact with each other. Then at the end of this year, we trained the individuals from the blue group to go up to this compartment here, and when they were up, the yellow guys could go in here, and so we did this kind of movement back and forth, so that both groups were familiar with this middle compartment. And what we then did is that we used a particular type of interactions, which is multimodal, and this, where one individual is showing off, in this case, individual A, and to the other one, and the other one, so this one says, I'm cool, and the other one says, I know. And this is what we basically took, and we recorded these sounds, the sounds the ravens make here, put them in the computer, reshuffled them a little bit, and then we could play it back to another individual, in this case of the same group, from the yellow group, and we could play it back in a way that it really matched the normal situation, so that individual A says, I'm cool, and individual B, B says, I know. But we could also play it back in a way that now suddenly individual B is saying, hey, I'm cool, and individual A says, hey, I know. So this is basically then a situation which is not correct, so it should violate the expectation of the receiver if it has an expectation about the other's rank relations. So we were hoping then to actually be able to measure a difference in its behaviors. And because we had this nice situation here, we could also not only test the birds about the knowledge about their own group members, so yellow to yellow, but also we could play the same thing back to individuals from the blue group and ask them if they know about the relations of the other group as well. So basically what we did in this experiment it was that we were simulating a potential rank reversal. And if it occurred concerned the raven's own group, then we exactly got what we predicted. Here you can see one of the parameters where the ravens responded. This is the amount of self-directed behavior they showed, which is a quite a nice measure for perceived mild stress. And this is when we played back an expected sequence versus an unexpected sequence. So the stress-related behaviors went up when they heard something which sounded like a possible rank reversal. We also got, and they also responded with being more active, but in this case we had an interaction with same with sex, and they became more active when they heard the playback they heard concerned their own sex, which makes a lot of sense because males and females have different rank hierarchies in ravens. So these patterns fitted perfectly. And then to the simulated rank reversal when it concerned the other group. And here we actually, I have to admit, expected that the pattern should be similar, just maybe a little bit weaker. But this was not the case. It was actually much better because the ravens responded with different behaviors. First of all, they vocalized more, and in both cases, also in all the cases, it was only the males who responded this time. We don't know why. But it was some males that vocalized more, and they also paid more attention. Attention here means that they are directing their head towards the loudspeaker. And So they did this more often, and now it comes in the expected condition as compared to the unexpected condition. So exactly in the reversed order. I have to admit that we didn't expect this at all, but we did get a significant difference. And so what I did is then that I went back and had a look at other playback studies that we conducted, and we always got the same pattern. They comment on things they know, and they are shut up on things they don't know. So in this case, it fits again. So what we can then conclude from those studies is that the ravens are capable of differentiating between playbacks that do and do not violate the rank relations of other ravens. Their responses differ when they violate when these violations concern their own group as compared to their neighbors. And this suggests that they can represent the other's rank relations and seem to be capable of inferring them by mere observation. Because remember, with the neighbor group individuals, they have never been in physical interaction. They could just watch them. So this was already quite nice. But then, of course, the next thing is, this is captivity and this is an experiment. So how do they actually use these kind of skills outside? And Kay has already mentioned in the hyenas that they are very happy to intervene in conflicts, also help one or the other one. And this is what ravens do too. So we thought, okay, let's have a closer look at this under the field conditions. And here now I'm very thankful to these two people in particular. This is Ake Koch, a Dutch intern, and this is Michaela Speriafico from Italy. And this is the corresponding PhD student, George Zippert, who helped us here as well. And so the idea was that to have a look on how often ravens are intervening in dyadic interactions, and we thought originally to focus on agonistic interactions. But then it turned out that there is also something else happening, which is actually even more interesting, and this is the reason I'm focusing on this now. And this is when we saw affiliative behaviors, like here these two are playing, and these are here these two are grooming. So focus on these two now. One is grooming the other one. And then you could have something like this. Suddenly a third party comes, boom, intervenes. And in this case, one has to go very often. Two have to go, both of them. So the third party is just coming, making them stop doing these kind of things, and they have to go. And this is a very mild intervention. It can be very rough as well, and it can become even bloody. So this was then something which we got interested in, and it turned out that this is a behavior which is occurring very as a relatively frequently. So in almost 200 out of about 860 observations, dyadic observations, about one-fourth of them were intervened. And the number of ravens that were involved around 90, so it's not always the same individual who's doing this. So this was already surprising that it's so often the case. And then the really cool stuff was that when we had a look what predicts these kind of behaviors, it turned out that it's the bonding status that is important, and namely both the bonding status of the intervener, the third party, and the bonding status of those two that are actually the target of the intervention. And the way it works is that the third party that is intervening were always strongly bonded birds themselves. So those that are socially very well integrated, they were intervening in the bonding in the affiliate interactions of other individuals. So the big guys, nice, are very well integrated, they intervene. So whom do they target? They target particularly those who are about to build up bonds. Not those that are already having their bonds, and those that don't have their bonds, they're targeting those that are building them up. And so this is also my conclusion then on this part. Bonding leads to an increase in rank and status. This is also what we can show very nicely in the field, by the way. But it also leads to an increase in aggression by other bonded birds. And interventions in affiliate interactions may function to prevent others from forming and or maintaining their bonds. And basically, this suggests that the birds seem to be aware of the other's bonding status, so in this case, affiliate relationships. And because they really try not only seem to be aware of them, but actually try to manipulate them, it really goes back to the term of politics, and in this case I would say they do actively politics. Of course, I have to admit that these are observations, so just correlative data, just qualitative data, but they are from the field. And we're still planning our experiments, and we are about to do those at the moment. So last but not least, I would just remind you that there is a very nice meeting next year in Vienna, the European Congress on Behavior Biology. So if you want to come to Europe, think about it. It's in July, and it's really a nice list of speakers, very cool conference. Everything so that, and last but not least, I would like to thank you for your attention. Thank my collaborators and funding agencies. Thanks.